Our guest for today's episode is Austin Turner, Software Delivery Manager at Foraker. Austin has a really interesting approach when it comes to recruiting and building teams, and I think there's a lot to be learned from his insights. Hope you enjoy this episode.
Welcome to episode 9 of Newey Tech People. Today we have Austin Turner. Thank you very much for coming.
Thanks, James. Great to be here.
Oh, good. Mate, we've met around Newcastle and have a couple of common people in our networks, but it'd be interesting for the people that don't know about you to give a quick overview of who you are, what you're currently doing.
Yeah, sure. So I'm currently the Software and Control Systems Delivery Lead for Orica, which is based in Newcastle with a fairly large technical centre. I think maybe a bit of background for people that haven't heard about it. Orica is the world's largest supplier of explosives and rock blasting services. We supply millions of tons of explosives and help to blast probably over 1 billion tons of rock every year. Wow. And we build a suite of software and control systems that we use ourselves and we sell to our customers to help them do that efficiently and safely. So I lead four teams. We build an engineering CAD design application to help engineers design the placement of explosives. We build a mobile application to help people out in the field to record measurements and get the instructions about how to do their role as best as possible. We build an embedded control system that controls explosives manufacturing on board our mobile truck fleet around the world. And we also build a fairly extensive cloud microservices layer that synchronizes all of that data, pulls it in for reporting, helps to integrate with business systems and things like that.
Wow, pretty small role then.
It keeps me busy.
I bet, man, I bet. You may mention there, so obviously a company that, you know, started out selling explosive equipment, now selling software as well. I don't think most people would think of Orica as a, you know, potentially like a SaaS company, right? I guess there's an element of that. How did that come about?
Look, I think Orica's always been a pretty innovative organization. So our approach to the explosives industry has always been to build industry-leading products. We've had industry-leading products across a whole range of categories that we sell. We initially had software tools for internal use by our services teams, and our customers just kind of started saying, look, we'd really like to use that. And so we took the approach of, there seems to be a market there. We've got some of these tools. Let's develop them into something we can actually sell to help our customers do their work better. Yeah. Orica has actually been recognised, I think, in the past 2 years, top 30 and then top 20 most innovative companies in Australia. Right. One of the subsidiaries we bought recently is actually rated number one most innovative company in Australia.
Wow.
And today I read that Thomson Reuters had awarded Orica top 100 most diverse and inclusive companies in, or publicly listed companies in the world. So I think Orica's always been like an innovative organization, but I think it's getting more recognition for that now, and it's exciting to be part of that.
Man, I bet it is. I bet it is. So how you've obviously, but how long have you been there now?
About 10, 12 years.
Yeah, it's a long time.
Yeah, I started while I was at university.
So you've seen a good evolution of that. Obviously, you may mention building technology for yourself, building software for yourself to start with, and then evolving that. How does that evolve from a team perspective for you?
So when I started in software, I was working in sort of product owner type role, very hands-on. I was talking to customers. I was taking the emails and customer support. I was deploying database updates. I was doing all sorts of things as we started to get our first web-based products off the ground. Basically, as that's grown in success and things like that, then the organization's invested pretty heavily into it. And I've really taken the opportunity to take sort of the leadership path, leading those teams as they've grown. I've recruited a lot of local people in Newcastle and built those teams up. So it's been really good.
Ah, so how big would the tech team be when you started?
We probably had about less than 10 people here.
And how many are we looking at now?
We'd be over 30. Here. We also have started, in that time, we've started a new development center in Denver. Yep. We have another development center in Stockholm. We also have other technology development that's done in Canada, a little bit else in Europe, a little bit in South America.
It's quite a journey.
Yeah, it's been good. I think that's one of the things that you don't get a lot of opportunity for in Newcastle, to be part of those kind of large global businesses doing technology at scale. And that's been a real interest for me.
Yeah, we must have, obviously, to spend, you know, 10 years of your life there. But it sounds like in that 10 years, the role's been diverse and it's grown through iterations of the role and, you know, into where you are now.
Yeah, I started in, like, technical engineering. So my job was to blow things up, basically. And then I did some account management, looking after customers, doing sales, negotiating contracts, things like that in New Zealand. And then I was really interested in the software tools I'd been using. So when the opportunity came up to be part of the development of those tools, I jumped at it. I'd always been interested in tech, and then I just went further and further down that sort of path of wanting to do more with software, wanting to help customers more with their problems, and software is by far the easiest way to do that.
I agree. Mate, that's a bit of a different approach, I think, than most software developers, right? I guess more traditional approach developer, you either teach yourself or you go through a university degree, you come out and you're a developer, you sit behind a computer and, you know, you code away, right? You've obviously gone about it from a different perspective, really, that account management in particular, like learning the customers, understanding what your customers need, and then going back and being in a more technical role. How do you think that's set you up to succeed? Like, I imagine that's invaluable information.
Oh, yeah, and I'm not a software developer. I also manage designers and QA and other people in the cross-functional teams that I lead. But really, I would say that my philosophy is you want a strong team. You want to build a strong team, and then you want to identify customers who have challenges you can solve and that they need solved and that it's valuable to solve. And then I would generally take the approach of connecting your strong team with those customers, and they will come up with a product together that solves that challenge. And I think that's the right way to go about product development. It's very, very customer-led. It's really just spending the time researching your customers, working out what it is that you can do that's valuable for them. I think it's not very likely that you're going to succeed if you just start with a product you're developing on your own, don't talk to any customers until it's sort of almost finished, and then you try to sell it. That's really like a one in a million chance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, as opposed to actually building a product for the customers, right? Like, they're leading you. You've already got ready-made customers there if they're telling you what to build, right?
Yeah, and often it's just the frustrations they express about the tools they have today or the way work's done today. It's the things they say about how they would like to improve their business. So the things that they would like to do better. And for us, a lot of that is about data. It's about visibility of data. It's about sharing data between teams of people doing different work. And it's about having great tools that really are easy to use. So we hired UX designers into like traditional industrial software. We've got UX designers who design our truck control systems, who design our mobile applications. And that's really sort of turned it around to being the software package that are easy for customers to pick up, implement, use, and get value from very quickly.
Yeah, and I imagine that's vitally important for the mining industry, obviously. I think, you know, making easily usable, I guess, software for that industry is gonna be vital, right? And it's vital for any industry, but I would think mining in particular, if you've got guys out there and, you know, on the sites, you wanna make it as easy as possible for them.
Yeah, that's right. I think a lot of people have really hard jobs to do.
Yep.
And they need tools that support them. They need professional tools that support them. So I can't imagine building a tool internally or customer facing without UX, without QA, without product management. And I think that's one of the things that has changed about our philosophy as we've become more mature as a product organization, which is going beyond just engineering to all those other aspects of building a really well-rounded product.
How did that evolve? That's really interesting, because I think there'd be a number of people and companies in Newcastle that are probably on that path themselves. I have a development team internally, building product, but haven't evolved to the level where you have, where, you know, you're looking at multiple aspects coming in there. How, mate, if you could give anyone some advice or some learnings that you've taken through that process, how's that building of that team evolved?
Identify and hire really passionate, driven people. I think one of the things I look for is people that have encountered situations where they thought things could be done better and they hadn't sort of just raised it as a concern or something. They'd actually taken really concrete action to go out and change the way things were done for the better. And so we've got a team that's really making decisions every day that make the way they work better, that make the products better. They're very passionate about what we do. We make sure that they all meet the people that they're building it for. So interaction with our customers is really important. Whether it's going out and meeting them regularly, whether it's the other day sitting on a conference call where we had a bunch of people remotely just viewing and giving feedback on new software, etc. And just for the team to sit around and see that and hear what the users actually think about it. It's been really good.
Nice. So that team's evolved. So if you said from a people numbers perspective, how's that grown over, you know, you've gone from 10 to, was it 20 now?
Yeah.
10 to 30 now?
I think we've been probably growing at about like 10 people a year or so.
Yeah, right. For the last 2 years. And you see that growth continuing?
I don't know if we'll continue to grow the teams a lot in Newcastle. We've got a pretty large tech representation here now. I think the strengths of the global business is that we can grow teams in Sweden, Denver, and there's a lot of benefits to having good self-sufficient tech teams in a variety of locations around the world. Just sort of the handovers and things like that, the connection to customers, so they can connect with customers more closely in their markets and provide that feedback to us, and we can provide feedback to them from customers in our region.
Yeah.
And I think it's very important for a business that you don't sort of pigeonhole yourself into just serving the customers that are around you. It's really to take that global perspective and build something for everyone.
Yeah, cool. Man, I'm just super keen, obviously, as a more traditional, as a company that was in one industry, morphing, or continuing to stay there, but also morphing into a tech company as well, right? Mate, how does the product that you're building fit into the overall sort of business strategy? Like there's obviously a difference between, I guess, a business strategy more traditional, hey, we sell really high quality explosive equipment, to now we're selling that plus that. How have you found that sort of that? Is there a mindset change? Is there a business change that went throughout the company to say, hey, we're now also a software company?
Oh, look, I think there's been a lot of sort of executive level leadership of strategies to make our company really more innovative, to connect it more with the needs of our customers. I think a lot of the focus though is not just on improving the product that we sell. If you look at technology and innovation, it's about looking at our customers' business and asking what can we do to unlock the most value? And that might be to deliver an improved product. It might be to deliver an improved service. It might be to simply allow them to better combine a variety of products and services together.
Yeah.
Really just to support their processes and their objectives. So they don't necessarily want just the best product in a category.
Yeah.
They want the most effective implementation of that entire rock breaking cycle in a way that feeds all of the downstream parts of their business as effectively as possible. And so Orica always looks at it from a perspective of how can we add the most value in aggregate to the customers. And so software as a service might be part of that, along with products, along with really reliable supply, manufacturing. We've got big factories in Newcastle and things like that as well.
Yeah, that's a cool story. Especially, I just think there'd be a lot of people that wouldn't know of, you know, the size, the scale, the fact that you've got international teams and that's happening locally, right? I really think that's part of the, you know, the reason behind me doing this podcast is to shine light on these type of things, because I imagine a lot of people would know the size and scope of your team and, you know, what you're actually producing here.
I think because we're based out of town, it does make it a little less visible for us. So we don't have like an office right in the CBD. So yeah. There's probably not as many interactions. You might not see the logo on the building, but we've really been quite active over the last 2 years in meetup groups. So there's several of us will go to the coders group. Several of us will go to the Newcastle JavaScript meetup, which big props to them, by the way. They're doing a really good job. That's a great meetup. Go to the InfraCoders meetup, and we'll have a reasonable contingent going to DevOps days shortly.
Yeah, how many people have we got going there?
I think we have about 9.
Wow, I love that. I love, you know, local companies supporting, you know, local events and things like that going on. There's a strong contingent of the people that I've interviewed that are going to go there, which is great.
Well, I think because of the nature of the way we run our cross-functional teams, each team is really responsible for building and running their product. Yeah. So it's not like we have two people off in the corner doing operations. Yeah. It's really a lot of developers are involved in some way in building, deploying their code, getting into production, keeping those products running. So when we did DevOps days and went around and said, well, you know, who has an interest in these kind of topics? A lot of developers put their hand up because they're in some way involved in that.
Yeah, nice. That's great. Mate, that's a really interesting story from Orica's perspective. Obviously, I'd be keen to sort of hear your story inside that. You come from, as you said, blowing up things to start with into technology. You've mentioned at a really, really high level just there, but I'd love to dig in. What took you down that path into, you know, where you're at currently from the background that you did start in?
So, like, I'm pretty interested in business strategy, product strategy, company strategy, etc. If I look at the world today, there's two classes of companies, really. Like, they're separating. There's the companies that have really made tech a core part of their business, and those are the ones that are massively more valuable. They're the ones that are basically dominating not just today, but for the foreseeable future. And there's the companies that haven't managed to make the transition to a really tech-led company, who are still sort of maybe attacking on technology as a back office function, separate from the business, separate from planning for the business. So I kind of realized that I really like those enormous high growth companies. I'm really excited about how they're actually managing to do that. Like, how did Amazon manage to disrupt retail, supply chain, wholesaling, you know, manufacturing, logistics? Like they're blowing apart the entire established ecosystem. And a lot of it is to do with the fact that they are a tech company that's just going and deciding what markets to play in.
Yeah.
And so I knew that, I guess, my interest in technology as well as my interest in business and product and things like that just kind of led more and more that way. And I think I always want to be involved in companies that are doing that.
Nice. I think you might be the first person I've interviewed that wasn't led by, hey, I've always had an interest in technology and I've always been a tinkerer, and, you know, that led me down the technology route, where you actually approached it to, hey, technology's more so the vehicle for helping you be involved in the greater strategy, and the business strategy is the important part, and technology is the vehicle for you to help drive that.
I think a lot of people spend a lot of time worrying about like certain aspects of their technology products. So I could spend a long time perhaps arguing about what JavaScript framework I should use. I could spend a long time arguing about, you know, whether I should use AWS or Azure or Google Cloud Platform.
Yeah.
If I'm building the wrong product, or I'm building a product that doesn't solve a customer's problem,
yeah,
it doesn't matter, because all of the money I'm investing I'm just throwing it away anyway.
Yeah.
So I think that's the important question to ask, which is, am I writing the right application? Am I solving the right problem? Can I get value from that?
Yeah, not actually what technology you're using to do that, right?
That's a secondary concern, and you need to balance that. You need to understand how those choices impact your ability to serve your customers. So I do spend a reasonable amount of time, whether it's, you know, thinking about different architectural patterns and microservices and how those things support our business objectives. Thinking about, okay, JavaScript frameworks, maybe in the case of reusability, how many teams are we likely to have? How big do we want this to go? We're building a design system now to help achieve design consistency across all our products. Which technology really supports us in doing that the best, rather than this one is purely technically superior in some way to another.
Yeah, right. So starting at the top, starting at the border problem, and then working your way down.
Yeah.
That's an interesting approach. Not uncommon. I think a lot of people do attack it from that perspective.
Yeah.
Especially the people that are putting out, you know, highly scalable or highly efficient products. Mate, what led this train of thought? Obviously, you know, you don't just wake up one day and think about things from a strategic perspective. Did you what sort of education background did you start with?
Well, I have a degree in mining engineering.
Yeah.
I would say that gave me foundational knowledge in a lot of things I don't use anymore but are interesting. So I can tell you a bit about geology and metallurgy and mining finance and things like that. But I think it's more just a natural inclination to long-term thinking and long-term decision making.
Yeah.
And then that's just supported, I guess, by the things I read and the things I'm interested in.
Let's go down that path, mate. Before we go down to books and other education, was there any other sort of formal education that you did outside of your degree, or any courses that you'd recommend for people to say, hey, I did this micro course or I did this XYZ that you'd recommend to people?
Not me personally. I've seen people have a lot of success with those courses. I've hired developers who've taught themselves using Udemy. I know developers who've been very successful starting with courses at places like General Assembly in Sydney. I've seen, actually, General Assembly has been really good. I've seen successful product managers, UX designers, and developers all come through those short courses.
Yeah.
Really like deliberate work-facing type skills. For me at the moment, I probably get most of my stuff from reading and actually talking to people.
Yeah, on the reading front, is that, are we talking books or are we talking blogs?
Both.
Yeah.
I think blogs can tend to be the new books in some circumstances. So if you're interested in tech strategy, product strategy, digital, Ben Thompson's Stratechery is very well regarded. I think actually Google recommends it for their product manager interviews, is how I first found out about it, because I read this thing about how Google introduces you to product management, right?
Yeah, so
basically you're coming along to an interview or whatever, you know, you should do these things, you should read these things. And one of them is Stratechery by Ben Thompson. So I went and had a look, and he'd spoken at Code Conference and things. And so I subscribed to his site, and I mean, I pay for that. You have to pay for good content. And so his daily newsletter just talks about all the tech news of the day in the context of business strategy. So spends a lot of time on social media, Amazon, Netflix, things like that, but also more traditional industries, maybe like media companies and things that are really being disrupted pretty quickly. On the people management side, if you found yourself managing a team of people for the first time, or you're looking to improve, I would suggest reading Slack and PeopleWare by Tom DeMarco, actually in the other order, PeopleWare first and then Slack. Those are probably the best foundation for how to think about trusting, respecting a team to work independently and just setting them up for success. And then I would say Manager Tools podcast helped me. I listened to that. That's where I got into the habit of things like weekly one-on-ones, things that really help you improve communication with your team, ways to improve communication with your managers and your peers. And I would probably always recommend How to Win Friends and Influence People, because it is a classic, and it goes a lot through thinking about human psychology, I guess, in your interactions.
Which is a big part of it, right?
It is.
And it's also an uncommon part when you get, tech leaders and tech managers who started from a very technical background and never had aspirations to go down a people management route, because people management is completely different to an extremely technical role. So I think it's a challenge a lot of people face, especially in the tech space.
Yeah, and I would say they're skills you can learn.
Yeah.
You can really find a lot of satisfaction from leading teams and managing people in the same way that you might get satisfaction from doing technical work or closing sales or whatever you've done in the past.
Yeah.
It can be daunting because people are complicated creatures, but if you start to think about the perspective of those business professional relationships, how you build those relationships, if you start to approach it as you and I need to work together, the best thing is that we communicate clearly, that we trust each other, that we respect each other's judgment. We won't do that if we only talk over email. So let's start to have like a fortnightly one-on-one, say, with your peers, or a weekly one-on-one with your boss or the people that work for you. Open them up by letting the other person speak. So I start my weekly one-on-ones with, "Hi James, what's on your mind?" I got that from Manager Tools podcast, but
yeah,
really that's all about just asking people to open up to you, and over time you can start to have those more honest conversations, and all the things come up that need to be discussed. You can receive feedback about yourself, you can learn to improve, you can give constructive feedback or positive feedback to other people.
Yeah.
And so over time, you find that all those relationships just make you more effective at work. It makes it easier to do your job.
Yeah, well, especially as you said, opening up the conversation with that and giving people the opportunity to, if it need to be vent, if it need to be just open up and have a discussion about what's on their mind. The platform to do that is something a lot of people probably don't get, right?
Yeah, so Manager Tools talks a lot about the imbalance of power between the manager and their direct report, and they explain that you're not always conscious of it as a manager. So if you always go to the people that work for you and you basically ask them, how's this deliverable going, or what's the status of this, that's how they frame the conversation from then on.
Yeah,
I'm achieving what I thought I would, or I'm not achieving what I thought I would, or so all the other things that they really would like to raise that they think you need to know, all those will get pushed to the side, you know, just to give you your status update, whatever.
Yeah.
So have the conversation, talk about the things that they consider are the most important to talk about.
Yeah.
And then at the end, once you've talked through all those things, you take the notes about the things you want to follow up. Then you've got the opportunity, you know, for you to ask other kind of questions, and they might be providing feedback you've had from their peers about how well they've done on something, or it might be asking for an update on how this piece of work's going, asking how some initiative or thing that they're trying to improve is progressing. So just, you know, do that at the end, like change that balance of power.
Yeah, I think your approach is very refreshing. It's So a leader, and it's in particular a tech leader, they're mentioning that, you know, the things that you're going to for reading and improving yourself is more around people and about management, as opposed to more technical. That's refreshing. I think it's also, you're probably in a minority there.
Look, I met a pretty good group of people. I was sort of splitting my time a bit between here in Sydney for a while, and the Sydney tech leaders meetup group in Sydney was really good, and I met some really good people there. And so that's probably another meetup for Newcastle, maybe the Newcastle Tech Leaders meetup. But I think it's important that maybe managers who don't tend to go to meetup groups and things because they're not really talking, not really opening up about the things that they go through. It's nice to be in a group and being able to talk about some of those situations.
And share the challenges you're facing, right? Because a lot of people face very similar challenges, and hey, if somebody's been there and done that before, no different to, you know, a meetups for somebody more technical. It's like, hey, you've been through the same problems or very similar problems. How can we learn from one another?
Yeah, that's right. And I think one of the main challenges I found on becoming a manager was you don't want to take the weight of the world on your shoulders. You really need to share that. So you need to be talking to your peers in the same organization or outside in the industry. And you also need to be sharing those challenges with your team, because your team will help you. Like your team will help carry, carry the workload.
I agree. So you mentioned a couple of books there, a couple of blogs, podcasts. Anything else that you'd recommend for other people? Because I think this is very valuable.
I think on my blog I've gone through a few topics, and basically I talk about things that I was trying to grapple with.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I would find is that I wasn't really sure about my position on a particular topic. So I would just write a blog post.
Yeah.
It would make no sense whatsoever. It would conflict with itself. I would read it. I would realize where I was conflicted. I would realize where I was confused. I would rewrite the blog post until I had resolved my position and I could read through it and go, yeah, that makes sense. Then I know the approach I should take, and also, you know, just hit publish. So that's delivering software on Medium, but I haven't updated it for a while, but I might go back to it actually.
Yeah.
And I have looked at other books. I think they tend to be more situational depending on what you're doing. If you're trying to run software teams, Leading Lean Software Development by Mary and Tom Popendick is very good. So I like the part where it says, let's pick apart like the current trend in Agile and find the things that have always worked since the start of software engineering, and let's find the things that are more kind of like passing fads. And it really breaks down to those things like being close to your customers, engineering quality into your applications, releasing early and often. And so you can start to see the trend over time of all the different kind of management frameworks that have been used. So that's really good. If you find yourself in a large organization, I would say that there's a book by Andy Grove, who used to be the CEO of Intel. My previous boss actually worked at Intel under him, and I'm struggling to think of the name of it at the moment. But High Performance Management, by Andrew S. Grove. So he talks about the challenges of management in a large organization, and that was as he was growing Intel. And you read that and you start to realize some of the things around you in large organizations, why they are the way they are, why it seems that it's always a matrix management model, and why this might seem difficult to understand from the bottom of an organization. When you look from a top down, you actually can't easily split up functional and divisional management in organizations and things. So that's a good one as well.
Nice. And I think there's enough there. We'll link all that up in our, show notes.
Yeah, I was going to say, I don't expect people to remember it.
But. No, we'll link all that up. And I think, you know, if people can get, you know, a couple of little bits and bobs out of each podcast, you know, I think my job's done. That's my objective for this, is obviously to shine light on what's going on around Newcastle, some of the, you know, the interesting people that are doing interesting things, and then if people can grab some learnings from other people that are succeeding, that's valuable, right? And I think everyone can learn from one another. Like, I'm sure that there's other locals that, as you said, you lean on. You've done that as part of the Sydney Leaders Group and things like that. And if you're continuing to learn, it's valuable for everyone, right?
Yeah, I think community is really important. I think developers and designers probably do it better than managers and some of the other functions. So just that tendency to have meetup groups to talk about the things that are important to them, start Slack channels, you know, new eSlack channel and everything else. You can just like go in and talk to people. We should do more of it.
All right, mate, I completely agree. And it's also always the people that, you don't have enough time, and that's probably the people that are most important for, right? It's like, hey, as you go up the chain, it's like, I got too busy with other responsibilities, when they're really the people that probably, you know, should take that step back, make some time every now and then, and really, you know, devote some time into that.
Yeah, I think I've always found if I don't feel like I've got enough time to think, then I'm doing some low priority stuff that doesn't need doing. So I just try to organize myself in a way that I can continue to be really responsive to the people like in my teams as well as the other people in the organization, at the same time as just removing anything that really doesn't need to be done. So example, big proponent of inbox zero. At the moment, my work email has one email in it, which is like marked follow-up. I've got Slack. I'm managing like probably 30 Slack channels, you know, in work Slack. I subscribe to every channel. I pretty much read every message. It saves me asking a bunch of like questions that I should know the answers to. It saves me disturbing people. I've got Confluence. I can go through, I can see all the updates, I can read what people are working on, I can review things that they're doing without bothering them. I can come back and ask, you know, informed questions and stuff like that. So it's all manageable as long as you take that really quick, I've got something, do I need to do something with it or not? Is there anything practically stopping me from resolving this thing right now? So I get an email and it's a request for information. It's a request to complete some task. It's a request for, you know, an approval or something. Is there anything that absolutely stops me from completing this right now? So most of the time the answer is no. So you can complete it instantly. And then you just have those things you need to follow up on. And then you're in the office and you've got three things for the day that you need to follow up on and really track down and really come up with the right answer or whatever.
Nice. Productivity, Len, you've just opened the door.
Mm.
Outside of that, is there any other, you've mentioned three tools that are just there, yeah. Anything else that you use from a productivity perspective?
I think my approach to productivity very strongly at work is everything is open by default. So the old model of, for a while, computers seemed to lend us to everyone having their private store of files and information. And so you would have to go to the person who had the information to get it and things. That should be long dead by now. If you're using email for most of your communication, you're just having point-to-point conversations. There's no transparency. And other people can't jump in there and add, you know, valuable insights, etc. So as long as you default to everything being open, maybe there's a few files, maybe it's some of your HR or some of your finance stuff or whatever, that's your small bit of private stuff and you might just share that with your manager. Everything else I do, Confluence, Slack, just make it open. It's all there. I went on holiday for a month recently and no one bothered me. I think I responded to one email about an audit for some information that was, you know, more of that confidentials type stuff.
Yeah.
Everything else just flows because everything's open, everything's there, it can be picked up, someone can be away for a day and you just carry on with the work.
Yeah. I think that's, once again, different approach to a lot of people, I think. I don't think that's the default position for most people or most companies.
I think it's very risky to take any other approach because you're basically siloing things and you're siloing information. And in that case, like, do I really think that keeping information to myself is going to make me more valuable? I don't think so. I think it's going to take a lot more of my time to retrieve it and give it to people all the time. So I can be a lot more valuable if I'm not serving 100 requests a day for like information that should just be open and public within the organization.
I agree. I still think it's not the default position. I think there are people out there that maybe be fearful for their jobs and think, hey, if they squirrel away information, that hey, they're the only people in the organization with that information, whereas they're potentially doing themselves a disservice because, hey, how are you ever going to get promoted if you're the only one that knows how to do your role in the way it is in its current format, right?
Potentially. I think the, I don't know, the 80% of the top 100 companies in the US using Slack and Atlassian now being at, I don't know, 23, sorry, 25, sorry, sorry, $30 billion, you know.
it just keeps ticking up as we're
talking, but like they're a lot about that default openness, the transparency.
Yeah.
So I think the world is changing pretty quickly.
Man, I completely agree. I think transparency, I try to operate in that way, which is obviously not default for the recruitment industry. But yeah, I think transparency is, you know, the way to go. I think, social media, you know, started providing, you know, more insights into, you know, who people are and that type of thing, you know, years ago. So I think, you know, who you are and what you do is, you know, a more transparent environment by it is becoming like default, right? And not only, you know, a work perspective, but just life perspective.
Yeah, I think certainly see not just people, but companies are struggling with that adjustment.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of companies like business models that have been built on, say, scarcity of information.
Yeah.
So you watch like newspaper industry, traditional media industry getting crushed by just sheer volume and availability of information.
Yeah.
The power of that now is just, it's just in discovery.
Yeah.
So whether it's Slack, whether it's Confluence, etc. Really, it's all about how well those products can surface the information you need right now for you and make it available to you.
Yeah, well, so much information is really available for free, right? That's where, as you said, like you actually pay for a subscription, for an email subscription, right? For content, access to content. You probably do that for two reasons. A, the quality of the information being put out, but B, you're actually paying for a service for saving you time. This guy's going ahead and, you know, pulling some information together on a daily basis for you to save you time and going out from multiple sources and bringing that together. He's providing a service for you, right?
Yeah, there's basically the internet is enabling all of these niche interests. So previously I might have had to subscribe to the Newcastle Herald and like hope that they surface one or two stories I'm really interested in the newspaper. Now I can go off and find a blog that's specifically about, you know, Cheshire cats, right? Because that is what I'm interested in. And a person who knows an awful lot about Cheshire cats can write a blog. They can probably charge me money for a blog on Cheshire cats. And out of the however many, like 5, 6, 7 billion internet users, right? There'll be enough out there to support that.
Yeah.
So if you think global, your addressable market is bigger than you can possibly imagine.
Correct. And that's where, you know, a niche within a niche within a niche, and there's a lot of businesses that are being extremely successful from that perspective. You don't have to, you know, appeal to everyone. That actual niche strategy is becoming more and more successful.
Yeah, it is. I think Mark Andreessen said they look for an industry with two or three incumbents with a large bundled product offering, and they look for a disruptive small company that's basically trying to come in and offer a small part of that unbundled.
Yeah.
You might have heard of one. It's called Netflix. basically, and then they invest in that company.
Yeah.
So you can just go and blow apart a multi-billion dollar, centuries old industrial company in a matter of months.
Yeah. Yeah. And people can move that quick, right? And it's that speed to market, which I guess that whole startup, or it's not only startups, but I guess there's less legacy there, and there's less, I guess the mindset to move quicker. Is you know, inbuilt or ingrained within a startup environment to move quick, and that can hinder some bigger, slower organizations, right?
Yeah, the barrier to entry used to be enormous. So basically, if I can start a company now to disrupt a large traditional enterprise, let's say that enterprise probably doesn't run their own servers on premise anymore, but maybe they do. Maybe they have like a legacy software stack that they've bought from a vendor that has been highly customized for them, and you know, they don't have the skills to change that anymore. Their business processes are all built on top of that, and they have a really large staff. All I have to do is use, let's say, AWS, and then all I'll do is I'll buy all of the platform services for AWS. So I don't need to worry about most of that. I go and take a bunch of libraries, pull them together, write some business logic code on that, offer that as a product, buy my like website template, buy my shopping cart template, plug them together, go into my potential customers, find out it's wrong, change a little bit of the business logic, tweak it until it's actually what they want. And then I have the product that works in the way that those customers would actually prefer it to work. And if you're still on that full like legacy company stack, what's your time to change? What's your time to respond to that? Years?
Yeah.
Millions? Tens of millions of dollars? Like to go through and actually adapt to that. And so it's very dangerous to be on a stack that's difficult to change.
Yeah. I completely agree. Mate, Newcastle, you've been obviously stayed around Newcastle for some time now. What keeps you tied to Newcastle? Obviously, for a guy like yourself, you've been presented plenty of opportunities within Orica to grow. Outside of that, have you ever considered somewhere else, or is there something? Why Newcastle?
Basically, I relocated here with my company from Auckland. I'd gone there after doing uni in Brisbane, and so really, like, the company brought me here. Once I got here, we enjoy it here. It's a nice place to live. I would say that the work is still interesting. My wife's been able to get a good job as a software developer here as well, and so it provides those opportunities and a pretty good lifestyle. I just think that Newcastle is just a nice mix between really big city at the moment, which it's not really realistic to afford to live in Sydney, with house prices the way they were at least 12 months ago. They're a little bit lower now. They're about the inverse of Atlassian stock price. But then once you're here, you just kind of settle in and you can have that lifestyle. And as long as there are companies here doing interesting work, and supporting the local tech industry, I think Newcastle will continue to be a better and better place. I think the one thing we probably need is we need one or more of the many startups around town to just hit it out of the park.
Yeah.
And then I think the tech industry here will really change. We've got our Canva or Atlassian or whatever based in Newcastle.
I agree. I think when I speak to a lot of tech professionals, I think, you know, people say that, you know, that is it. You know, that would be the holy grail, so to speak, is to get a big, big player to have a headquarters in Newcastle, or at least one of their biggest offices in Newcastle. And whether that be homegrown, you know, tech company from Newcastle that makes it big, or a international company or a global company that comes to Newcastle and say, hey, there's a strong enough talent pool here that for a multitude of reasons that we're going to build a head office here and have it situated in Newcastle, that would be the end game for a lot of people.
Yeah, it would be great. I mean, like, I guess the market for high performing tech talent is national. So a lot of the people I've recruited here, we've just advertised and brought them in from other cities in Australia. Newcastle seems to have been a pretty positive change for a number of people that have come in. They like being close to the beach. They like having a good company to work for. They like still having, I guess, the convenience of a nice city location. The market for really top performing people is international. We've got people based in Newcastle that work for large international tech companies. They work remotely. That's kind of the trend is going. Top tier tech companies will recruit from anywhere in the world.
Yeah.
So I think that's one of the other opportunities for Newcastle that doesn't really get talked about a lot, which is those people that live here and work for some of those real tier one tech companies.
Yeah, I completely agree. And once again, a lot of people don't know about those people and those opportunities, right? So I think that's it. It's just, you know, sharing more of that, building that community. I think the tech community is definitely on the right path. It's definitely growing. I can't see it slowing down anytime soon. I hope it continues to grow. And I think, you know, a lot of the things that we've talked about is, you know, people helping support the community, build the community, share their knowledge with other people. We'll just continue to, you know, that evolution.
Yeah, it won't do that by itself. If we don't get out and talk at meetup groups, if we don't organize DevOps days, if we don't organize other conferences to come here, everything withers. everything dies. So for all the people, I guess, that are passive in the community, and I'm certainly guilty of being a passive member of the tech community, I think it's easy to look at that and say, really, if we want a strong community, we need to be more involved, we need to be more active.
Yeah.
And absolute props to the people who already are doing that.
Yeah. Oh, it just takes, it's just, you know, it's a community aspect, really. You just need, you know, multiple people to pitch in. And that's all it takes, right? As you said, you attend a number of those meetups, and there's some people that have been putting their hand up to put those together for a long time. And there's a lot of, you know, local companies that help support with that, which is great. So I think it'll continue to grow. I definitely hope it will continue to grow. I'm trying to, you know, be a little piece in that puzzle and growing that through the podcast, and there'll be a website soon.
I mean, I think also what you do, not just the podcast, but I think the recruitment thing is really important. I would say that it's easy in a town like Newcastle with traditionally a smaller number of companies. People tend to stay at the organizations for a very long time. And that's very good on the surface for the organization. But overall, if you want to have the best team, you want people with a diverse range of experience. So I think people do need to move around the tech industry, look at those opportunities that are available. I know that the people who have worked for several companies who have done a variety of different roles, they're generally higher performers overall because they've had the opportunity to learn those new things, see other ways of doing things. So I think, you know, what you do to just facilitate that movement of people throughout the industry is really important, you know, because it helps us all.
I agree, I completely agree from the perspective of, you know, people that have seen different environments, worked under different people, different leaders, seen different tech stacks. It opens their eyes to, you know, new ways of doing things, better ways of doing things, sometimes worse ways of doing things, but at least that, again, is a learning experience. It's like, hey, I've learned, I've been seeing this, it's definitely not the way I've done it. And you bring fresh eyes into a new organization, you help the other existing people there level up as well, right? So I think traditionally Newcastle had fewer options for tech people. That was probably the big four. And you had four options if you're in Newcastle. And once you tick one of them off, you're down to three. Once you tick that one off, you're down to two. So, and that used to be the mindset. So people were probably more inclined to stay in that one place for, you know, a while. Where I think Newcastle is growing, where there's more options for tech professionals. There's more traditional companies which are now having to make technology a significant part of their business, and technology, they would have never had a technology team in the past. They might have, you know, outsourced to an MSP or something like that, whereas now they're bringing some tech talent in-house, and some of them are building that. And, you know, Orica, as you said, mining company or explosives company that's now also a software company. I'm not saying all companies go down that route, but I think technology will continue to play a bigger, bigger part of more traditional organizations as well.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I think that that sort of outsourcing core business was probably a phase that the industry kind of went through. I think we went from sort of traditional IT taking off the shelf type tools and like plugging them in to, we need to customize this more to support our business processes. So they sort of outsource that work, you know, build it to specifications. Where we got to is that my ability to change and adapt my organization is the most important thing I can do in order to be successful and stay successful. My ability to change and adapt is so much higher if I have a core team in-house who can do that work, who can quickly change the tools that run our business, and then more using other companies, in particularly a software as a service type thing. So you want to be consuming lots of software as a service, and then also using maybe some outsourced development to do particular work where you can package it up and have something delivered. We've worked with various vendors. We've worked with some local software vendors in Newcastle as well, and like that's been a really great experience. It's really great working with a local team at another organization who can build things for you and work really closely and collaboratively with you,
yeah,
rather than perhaps being offshore in another time zone, etc. So it's nice to have a bit of that mix, but if your business runs on technology and you don't have the ability to build it and change it, your ability to build and change is slower than your competitor. You're always going to be behind.
Yeah. Okay. And thanks for your time today. I think you've definitely given a different perspective on not only technology as a whole, but management and different aspects and different ways of looking at things. Is there anything else you'd like to share with people?
No, I mean, I'm always happy to talk about these things, and I would like people to talk to you sometimes about some of the challenges I have. I'm also really happy to talk through things with other people. I'm really happy to share what we've learned so far and hopefully learn from others. So, you know, come and talk to me at JS Meetup. Come and talk to me at any other meetups I'm at.
We'll also link up your blog.
Yeah, look up my blog. Hit me up on Twitter at AustinTurner01 on Twitter. And I'm happy to talk about anything and provide other recommendations. Also, I think like mentoring and stuff's really important. So if someone's like in a tech role or something and interested in getting into more of like leading a tech team or something, reach out to me, right? I'm happy to sit down and like talk to people and just try to help where I can.
Cool. And thank you again for your time.
Thanks, yes. James. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
If you enjoyed today's episode, you can find everything we talked about in today's episode in the show notes on our website at www.newytechpeople.com.au. That's Newey, N-E-W-Y, Tech, T-E-C-H, people.com.au. So if you want to stay up to date with everything that's happening on the podcast, follow us on social media. Just search for Newey Tech People. Have a great day.